Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo Is There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Rick Childs, and we are going to be discussing Farmer in the Sky by Robert Heinlein, which was awarded the Retro Hugo for Best Novel in 2001 for the year 1951. So, Rick, thank you for joining me.
Oh, Seth, thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. So what should people know about you?
Well, I am in my early 60s and a longtime reader of science fiction. I'm a bank acquisition consultant by trade, but have always had a love of reading and in particular science fiction. And unlike some of your other guests, I was one of those odd folks that filled out the contact form and said I'd really enjoy talking with you about one of the books. So.
Yeah, actually, that's the contact form has yielded quite a few guests, so I'm glad that it's working. And you found the podcast just through you were reading books and looking for discussions of them?
It was, yes. I enjoy listening to podcasts, and I find myself getting into a rut, so I started to expand the various types of podcasts, and one of the things that I've always enjoyed is science fiction, and so I listened to a few science fiction podcasts, which led me to your podcast, and enjoyed the format, enjoyed the content of being the Hugo Award winners, and that's sort of how I came to be one of your listeners.
Nice. And we were talking before we started recording, and you said that your science fiction reading had been focused on stuff that you read when you were younger, right?
Definitely. Definitely. We were fortunate growing up in that my parents were significant advocates for reading. We were at the library quite frequently. We had a home library that my parents had sort of accumulated various books. And we had, not surprisingly, we had three series of juveniles that were popular in the 50s, 60s, one being Chip Hilton, the sports series written by Coach Claire B., one being the obvious Hardy Boys, which seems like every young boy had at one point or time. And then because my father was a scientist, we had Tom Swift Jr. Hmm. And that was my original introduction to science fiction. I had several relatives that helped me sort of foster my love of more science fiction. I had an older cousin who introduced me to Doc Smith's Lensman series. I don't know that my cousin Donnie knows this or not, but I still have his series of books, which I have not yet returned. All these some 50 years later, but that's okay. I still treasure them. And then I have three older brothers. The two middle ones were the avid science fiction readers, and so they introduced me to more adult fiction, including Heinlein and Clark and Asimov, Le Guin, Del Rey, etc. And when I got older, into the sort of the more avant-garde, such as Vonnegut and Philip K. Dick. And even to this day, I've got one of my brothers continues to send me recommendations. And that's how I came to discover Peter F. Hamilton and his broad sweeping sagas from that standpoint. So always lean towards that always enjoyed in the what I watch on TV or in streaming or in movies. So it all started with just reading that one series, Tom Swift Jr., and sort of blossomed from there.
Nice. Did you happen to tally up your Hugo count?
I did. I have read 17. Most of them are the earlier editions of things in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. I thought I actually had read more until I realized a number of them are only Nebula Award winners, like Darwin's Radio. Mm. I was for sure that it was a Hugo Award winner, and I never saw it on your list. And it's like, okay, Let me go check on this. And it's like, sure enough, there it is, a Nebula Award winner. So,
yeah, there end up being lots of books that will say, you know, Hugo nominated author or something, or Hugo Award winning author. And so sometimes that can be distracting, where I'm like, oh, maybe I need to get this one because it'll come across on like recommendations from BookBub or one of the other early bird books. And I'm like, oh, let me click through to that one. And then, oh, okay, it's an author that won the Hugo as a short story. And they have a bunch of books too.
Yep, definitely.
Yeah. So I'm sitting at 73 now. So really getting down to it.
So yeah, well, that's kind of fun. With a podcast like this, which was obviously the basis for why you did it, so you would read through the list. And we're coming down to the nitty gritty at the end. So, yep.
So I will put an appeal out for the last three titles that I don't have unclaimed, or that, sorry, that I do have unclaimed at the end of the episode. So normally I ask, you know, why this book? But at this point, there's only a few left on the list. And so I just wanted to ask, is this book, Farmer in the Sky, is that a reread for you, or is it a, was it a new one?
It was a new one. I've read a fair amount of Heinlein, but I had never read any of his juveniles. And through another podcast, I had come across a discussion of juveniles, and in particular Heinlein juveniles. And given sort of my basis for starting with the Tom Swift juveniles, which we would now today call young adults, I thought this would be a really fun one to read, to see how he addresses the sort of the audience and how Heinlein-esque he is in his prose compared to what you would read, for example, in The Moon is a Harsh Mistress or others. So it's it was kind of interesting to do that from that standpoint. And what I found was it was very compelling. And so it's for somebody wanting to get into Heinlein, I find it to be an interesting gateway because it's written well. It moves along at a good pace. And so it's it was very pleasant to read as a result of that. So I picked it primarily for that reason, but was happy at the end when it's like, I'm sort of sad to see this over.
Yeah. And we'll get to that, I'm sure. So on that note, why don't we kind of move into our official non-spoiler discussion? Do you want to give a quick, you know, what is this book about?
Sure. Yeah, it's interesting. And the basis is the population growth is outstripping resources on Earth. That's the primary basis for it. And so we have rationing of resources. And so they open up some of the other satellites and planets for colonization. And in this case, it's Ganymede, one of Jupiter's satellites. And it tells the story of one family through the, because it's a juvenile, through the teenage son's viewpoint, and tells kind of what the experience was like being a pioneer and a colonist.
Yeah. I think that's perfect, actually. It doesn't really give away much about it other than it's, you know, it's Ganymede. Yeah. There's some interesting stuff with this book where just, you know, there's a there's asides about things like, oh, and there's aliens on Mars and Venus, or evidence of previous habitation on Mars.
Correct.
And Venus. Yep. But, you know, it's not really germane to the plot of the novel in any way.
No, not at all. And then and then they never really answer the question because they have colonized Mars and have colonized, have a permanent colony on the moon. They never describe what the populations of those planets are and how do they stand in terms of their ability to support resources. So not surprising. I think every author can be forgiven not going into there's a decent amount of world building, so to speak. But it's not overly done, and it's not, it doesn't take over the book. It's there, I think, to move it forward mostly without answering a lot of the questions.
Yeah, I feel like you could see, you know, a universe in which this book is set in Heinlein's broader universe. And
it is.
Yeah. And essentially it is right in the juveniles, essentially.
But yes, it could have a much tighter tie to his other juveniles.
Yeah, to The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, Stranger in a Strange Land. You could definitely see explicit ties to those. Yep. But there's no need to do that for a book of this scope.
No, and not one written in 1950, effectively. Right. So,
yeah, absolutely. So, in terms of overall thoughts, I mean, it sounds like you had started saying that you enjoyed this one.
I did. You know, it was interesting in that I felt like it moved along at a good clip. I thought that the writing was reasonably decent level it's obviously geared towards young adults. As a matter of fact, the book was serialized in Boy's Life, which is now Scout Life, the magazine of the Boy Scouts of America. And so one of the interesting things in there is that as a result, every chapter has some reference to scouting in it.
Right.
And I remember reading through the first time wondering why this particular point was being made about scouting. And then I went and reread the dialogue around his juveniles. And it's like, okay, well, that makes sense now. He's writing it for Boy's Life. And so it was on purpose that there is a fair amount of scouting that is highlighted in there. And I had read, I think it was on the autobiography that his wife published after his passing, that that he had chose this format and the juveniles as a way of promoting his quote propaganda, which I think was creating a broader, there were two reasons, creating a broader audience for science fiction in general. Mm-hmm. The theme of the book is, I think, self-reliance in a large part. And then in a more sort of practical viewpoint, it was to have a secondary source of income. So he had his regular serializations and novels and writing that he was doing in adult science fiction. This was just another way of taking his talents and providing a separate source of income,
yeah,
which he did well at.
Mm-hmm. I actually had a subscription to Boy's Life when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Although I was never actually in Scouts. I was in Royal Rangers, which is like the scouting offshoot of the Assemblies of God.
Right.
So it's scouting plus the Bible.
That's exactly right. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. I think I was a trailblazer. I think you started off as a buckaroo.
Right. Well, so. Yeah. So I only remember back when I was a kid that we had Cub Scouts and then regular Scouts, and now they have multiple variations on it, just like the Girl Scouts have. And, you know, interestingly, scouting, at least in the U.S., has a heavy tie to the Methodist Church. So, and as you know, us Methodists, we were definitely middle of the road on a variety of topics. So
yes. Yeah. Yeah. So overall thoughts from me, I mean, I really enjoy a book that goes down easy. And, this one definitely is that. It was a little, actually it was a little longer than I thought it would be, but, I don't know, it's still on the brief side, especially in comparison to a lot of the Hugo winners. It's kind of in the same range that you get in this era, right? Where stuff was serialized does not overstay its welcome and, generally easy reading. The fact that it's a juvenile too.
Yeah. I think that's right. It's efficient and effective at the same time. It. I think there could be more offshoots, as we say, that they could go down, but they Heinlein elected not to do that, and so it is a pleasant read because it moves along at a good clip.
It does, yeah. And I mean, you could envision a way where this book could have been, you know, 300-400 pages because there's some skips, right? It's like, you know, 2 years later, things had gotten better.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. There are some. And then, you know, it feels like at the end of the novel, there is some wrap up. So it's almost as if here's the serialization. So it's hard to tell whether he wrote the book for Scribner originally and then serialized it, or he wrote the serialization and then with the plan always to convert it into. And so the last part of the book is does move along with some good fix ups, so to speak. So.
Yeah. And, you know, I got to the end of it and I thought, is this the first in a series? Because it really feels like the first book in a series. Right. And it sort of is, but I haven't been able to find that there's any other books with Bill as a main character.
No, I don't believe that there is.
Hmm. Because I expected to see, you know, the future adventures of Bill and Gretchen, you know, getting married and starting their own.
You would think so. Yeah. And it leads me to something else that I was thinking about. So there are several times during the book that there's a description of the kinds of subjects and topics that they learn in school.
Yes.
And they're fairly advanced. And so my kids are adults now in their late 20s, early 30s. And I recall as when they were in school thinking, I don't think I did that until I was in seventh grade, and we're doing it now in like third grade.
Sure.
And it just had advanced. And so you sit there and think about all of that, but at the same time, the main character is naive around a variety of things, including never picking up that Gretchen is interested in him.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, he's too busy with other stuff.
Well, he is, but he's also sort of emotionally naive.
Yeah.
Very, very in a certain way street smart, and in a certain way book smart. But when it comes to some of the emotional aspects, proving that the teen's brain is never fully formed until much later, he misses out on several things.
Yeah, he does. That. And the weird thing is, too, like, he's surprisingly mature in a lot of ways. Like, his relationship with his father, they're on a first-name basis. You know, his father's a widower. And then yet, you know, George gets remarried suddenly, and Bill kind of has a pity party about it.
Right.
So.
Yeah, Bill freaks out about it. And the other thing that is kind of interesting is I think he always views his dad, George, as a bit of a bumbler when he's an accomplished engineer, has his own business. But because he sort of doesn't do things a certain way at home, and because Bill takes care a lot of the responsibilities that his mother, Anne, would have taken on, right. He views his father as being a bit helpless. And throughout the novel, I think that comes into focus for not only Bill, because it's obviously told from his viewpoint, first-person viewpoint of Bill, that he comes to, I think, appreciate more about his father than he did at the beginning of the book.
Yeah. It mentions early on that his dad is completely clueless in the kitchen, which it sounds like the kitchen is essentially, you know, you're just nuking everything. So
yeah, exactly. So here we are in 1950, right? Yeah. Predicting a microwave before it existed. And so there were several things that sort of popped up from a technological standpoint that did come to fruition eventually, and then others that still haven't. So, but yeah, it was rather interesting that, to be a wizard in the, you know, is to get out a frozen dinner and to cook it. So.
Right. Well, and it talks about, he puts together sort of a complicated meal, and then he says, it had taken two minutes start to finish.
Yeah, exactly.
Including a baked potato.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
So that was fun. I guess one thing I would say about this book is it has a hard science fiction sort of leaning to it without being super strict about it, right? There's some fanciful stuff, the whole matter converter, you know, it's conceivable technology, but nothing that we have yet.
I'd say there's some real plausible science that exists in there that is not contradicted. I mean, how they create gravity, for example, is, you know, certainly seems accurate. Other aspects of it, with what they knew at the time, again, seems reasonable, but with further exploration, they found out some of the things that happened in the book couldn't have happened. So.
Yeah. I mean, the one big one for me that I read it and I went, not sure that's right, was there's the discussion of why the essentially skin of the ship is so thin.
Yes.
And he says, well, you know, stellar particles, if they interact with a large amount of metal, then they turn into, you know, something worse that's dangerous for humans. And I thought, there's plenty of radiation out there that'll fry a human without adequate shielding.
Exactly.
I don't know that he knew about Van Allen belts and that kind of stuff
yet. No, I don't think they did. And, you know, the interesting thing is that, you know, if you think about the lunar lander, the skin was thin for one reason only, weight.
Yeah. Whereas something that's, you know, never going to be in a gravity well, you don't need to be quite that conscious of it, especially since with the efficiency of their drive systems and that kind of stuff.
Right. He did not overly glamorize the trip from Earth to Ganymede. And so you think about some of the various things like passengers, for example, and others. Yeah, it's nothing like that at all. And right. I recall one passage where what struck Bill the most about the spaceship was the smell.
Yes. Yeah, and that kind of reminds me of, you know, hearkening back to colonization ships here on Earth, right?
Yeah, exactly.
They're gonna pack as many of you on there as they can, and you're gonna be on that boat for a long time.
Yep.
Probably not real nice conditions.
No, I don't think so.
So, yeah, I kind of look at this book as like, if you want a book that explores every little thing about what it would take to terraform someplace, the Mars series has you covered. You can read those. It has all the details and more. Where here, it's much kind of the lighter. It's like the Hobbit versus the Lord of the Rings kind of thing.
It is. Yeah.
Targeted at a younger audience.
It goes into a decent amount, as you said, it goes into a decent amount of discussion around the science aspects of it. But it's,
it doesn't get bogged down though.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
I was outside. We have a community leaf drop-off event here a couple times during the winter. And this year, the first one was too early. And so none of the leaves were down. And so I had to get it all done in one day. And so I had gotten the audiobook for Farmer in the Sky that I plugged in while I was doing the leaves, listened to it in one day very easily. It was only, I don't know, 6 hour audiobook. So then I went back and read it in print, finished it yesterday. So,
yep. It's either way, either format, it does go by in a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah. It's one of those books where I've definitely had the experience where I sit down to read, and I read for an hour and I'm like, how did I only get, you know, 25 pages? And where this one, I would sit down for an hour and I'm like, oh, I did 70 pages. I don't generally anymore read mass market paperback, but that was the only format I could find it in. So I just attached myself to my reading glasses and made sure I had adequate light, and it worked. But they're, you know, they're kind of thin pages too, and narrow pages.
They are. Yep. It, I mean, it, like you say, sometimes you're into a book and you really think, I've had this happen several times on various kinds of fiction where I start reading and it takes so long to get started that I stop reading and I come back to it. And it's like, if I can get past the first fourth of this book, it really picks up and is wonderful. That was never a problem here. It starts off in action going and doesn't really let up. So,
yeah. I say we just jump right over into spoilers and continue the discussion.
Sure. Yeah, you good definitely. With
that? Okay, yep. Cool. You mentioned some of the stuff about the almost precociousness of the youth characters and what they study in school. And there's a quote early on, like everybody, I had had the elements of space ballistics and grammar school physics.
Yes. Yeah, it's funny that their education is advanced and such. One of the things that always, and I've seen criticism of the book in this regard, which is we have food rationing.
Right.
And by the way, Heinlein wrote about fake beef well before it actually existed. So it was all synth steaks and such back in the day.
Yes.
But even with this resource rationing, you can apparently travel anywhere you want without any regards for resources.
Right.
And he's got his early trip in the
with
scouts.
With the scouts, yeah.
And then he's got his trip to Antarctica, I think, for school in that regard. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, we solved this problem, but we can't solve the food problem. So,
yeah. I think, to me, reading it, those early trips are to set in contrast later with how little of Ganymede he sees, right? Because it's all walking, or if you can get a ride from somebody.
Exactly. And the rides were not plentiful. And if I recall right, I think he said in the latter part of the book that when he goes on one of the expeditions to map out more of the satellite, that he'd only ever been 50 miles from the center of town.
And at that point, he was considering going back to Earth and thought, how can I say that I've been to Ganymede when I've only seen, you know, this town and environs?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it literally wasn't. I mean, there was no mass transit system because of just the sheer cost of, you know, they have to make themselves self-sufficient. That's the whole goal of the colony at some point in time, because it's just too costly, both in terms of dollar amount and or resource allocation to be able to continue to provide everything there. But there really is, in a lot of ways, much like you were at the late 1800s, early 1900s before a lot of mechanized travel, they have a few mechanized vehicles, transports, but a lot of it is, you know, horse and other, and it's rather interesting from that standpoint. And they only have one, at least at that point, they only had one spaceship, which effectively ferries passengers and freight up in between the ship and the surface. So they don't really use it until later when they need to map more of the planet. They don't actually use the spaceship for anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the amount of equipment that they have, you know, they have some precious pieces of equipment like the rock crusher and that kind of stuff, but they don't have, you know, a lot of tractors and that kind of stuff because horses don't break down and they can reproduce themselves.
That's
so
right.
They're a little more valuable on the colony, especially if they want to become self-sufficient.
That was one thing that was interesting was how they ended up having so much food on Ganymede.
Right.
Food was never a problem, and I forget what the population was before the most recent colonists arrived, but I didn't gather it was overwhelming.
No, I think he said at the time of the disaster it was something like 30,000.
Yes.
Whereas 6,000 of them came in on that one ship.
Right? Exactly right, yeah. So with all of that hand farming, they were able to produce a fair amount of their own food so that they, you know, in a couple of cases when they were trying to get people to perform work, they effectively said, we'll feed you for the next 2 years. And so that was never seemingly a problem for them being able to produce the food And then obviously the next version was going to be moving from a agricultural state into one that is mechanized and or industrial.
Right.
Which is sort of where they were heading. So it was rather interesting.
Yeah. One of the interesting things about the perspective of being a teenager from the 50s, more or less, is it talks about how all the colonists had to get their medical details tattooed on them.
Yes.
So if there's a medical emergency, which I think is a great idea. But then the, 1950s Robert Heinlein opinion about how, well, the women, they get invisible tattoos, that only show up under IR or something.
Right.
Or UV, right? Or on the soles of their feet, because I guess it, God forbid, a woman should have a visible tattoo.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, there are some of that. I mean, the book, because it's written for a youth audience, it lacks some of the, it certainly lacks any real sex and or the misogyny you would see in other adult fiction of the time for science fiction. And it has a fairly standard gender stereotypes and gender roles that exist in there, but there's nothing that is from that standpoint. But yeah, there are a few idioms like that where the women certainly are made to be vain at times, and the men are, for the most part, hardy. There are a few that are not. That was one of the story plots that sort of unfolded over time, which was that to get on to the colonization ship, you went through this battery of tests. Some of the more normal ones you would think about for space flight, but then health tests and
G tolerance
and psychological tests. And the idea was to wean out the people that wouldn't thrive in the colony.
Right.
And yet somehow they managed to send up a number of people that actually don't thrive in the colony and struggle with that aspect of it. And it leads to an interesting dialogue between Bill and his father, George, around how is that possible that this lady that is complaining and thinks that she should be the center of the captain's attention and is dismayed to find out she's not.
Ends up washing dishes for the rest of the trip.
Right. Yes. Cause to believe that your captain tells you something, you should follow it. He makes clear quickly on the very first, the first part of the trip. But it's an interesting dialogue around, well, how did they even get on here? To which, sort of George illuminates Bill around, money and
political influence.
And it's another sort of insight for Bill that, maybe his dad isn't as helpless as he thinks he is in the whole thing.
Yeah. The perspective in the book is from this kind of teenage boy perspective. And there's some of where reading it for me, as a brother of three sisters, I can read some of the stuff and be like, yeah, I remember thinking that way because, at first he refers to Peggy, his new stepsister, as the brat. You don't even learn her name for a while. Yes. And I still have no idea how old she was.
No. Yeah, it's unclear as to whether she's because Bill is he 16 or 17 somewhere?
Yeah, something like that.
And so it's not clear whether Peggy's 8 or whether she's 10.
Right. I get the impression she was on the younger end.
Yes.
Because she is referred to as the baby at some point as well.
Right.
But he was opining about her and he says, I think girls should be raised in the bottom of a deep, dark sack until they're old enough to know better. Yeah. Then, when time came, you could either let them out or close the sack and throw them away, whichever was the best idea.
Right. Yes.
That is the perspective of a boy with a sister that he doesn't care for.
Yeah. And part of that just comes from where he's at in his life in terms of how they viewed women at the time and girls. And then Peggy is thrust upon him as, there are a couple of times where maybe George is hinting at it, but Bill doesn't pick up on it. But I'm not sure I picked up on it until he sprung it, which is that they only want families to make the trip and colonize Ganymede.
Very traditional families.
Right, exactly. Yep. And And so George sort of has brushed it off and said, oh, they'll probably take us. That's not a problem because of our skill set and how good we are.
Yeah.
He just is effectively kicking the can down the road until he has to spring it on Bill one day that he's getting married.
Yeah.
What he hadn't been telling Bill all along is that he's actually been seeing or dating or has feelings for Molly,
right.
Which I think is she's at his work. Mm-hmm. And it just comes as such a shock out of the blue that, as you say, he has a meltdown and can't believe it. And it's after they've had this long dialogue around George's desire for Bill to stay behind on Earth and get his education.
So yeah.
He's so close to graduating and going to college to get his education and finally relents. And it's actually an interesting moment between the two of them because they sort of counterpunch each other around a little bit verbally and emotionally. And at the end, in almost like a given the time of the year, gift of the Magi type approach, Bill comes up with an adult version of his coming to grips with it. And then George says, well, I put you in 2 or 3 days ago. So,
yeah. And I mean, it's one of those things, right? If they had just had a little clearer communication all along, it would have been cool because you have that moment where Bill says, I can't believe that you would marry her just so that you can go to Ganymede. And he says, no, look, son, we're going to Ganymede because I want to marry her.
Right.
And I don't want to raise a family here and all of this.
No, that's right. But yeah. And it's one of those things where, kids of that age, even into early adulthood, don't probably appreciate what it's like for a widower or a widow in terms of the loneliness and the need for companionship. And that never had crossed his mind that, that his dad would like to remarry at some point anyways. And that while they have a partnership, as they call it, and it works fine, it just means that the day-to-day stuff gets done, but it's not necessarily meeting his emotional needs.
Yeah.
Or other, which we couldn't talk about in a young adult novel anyways, but
no, definitely not. You know, the book doesn't spend a ton of time on the shipboard side. It's the early part of the book, right? Just enough to kind of give a flavor for how everything works for them to get started on scouting aboard ship. Cause they're there for, I think, 60 days, they said.
Right.
Yep. And it is kind of fun that at the very beginning of the book, you introduce Bill and this pest who was with him, who is you know, being annoying on their flight back.
The very first scene, so to speak.
Yeah.
Hank is, and the funny part is because Bill has had to have sort of an adult role within their parental unit or their family unit. He's a little more mature in some regards on some aspects. He's definitely duty bound by that, whereas Hank is just a traditional teenager and doing teenage kinds of things, which is let's see how far I can push the limits of things, and it just annoys Bill to no end.
Yeah. But then aboard ship, he basically finds out that, look, this isn't somebody that I like very much, but he is a familiar face.
He is.
And they, you know, I like the fact that they start to get along a little better. And then, you know, some of Hank's proclivities kind of help out. Like, hey, let's see if we can go up to the control room. No, we're not allowed up there. Are you sure? Right. Let's go ask. You
know? Yes. They get an audience with the captain of the ship, and he pushes Bill outside of his comfort zone multiple times, and that's good, as we find out in the end. So, but yeah, they have that, and so then we replace Hank with Noisy, and he becomes sort of Hank's antagonist throughout the rest of the book, he's a youth. They set it up as he's the youthful version of some of the adults that are encountered during the colony, and they both have similar behaviors, just more suited to each other. But
demanding but kind of useless.
Right. Yes.
Because even then, you know, they introduced the captain's mast, right, where it's like a drumhead court with the captain where he can hand out punishments and rewards. They don't mention the rewards in the first one.
No.
But they set that one up so that then once we have this hole puncture that happens in Bill's quarters, where also Noisy Edwards is, where Noisy is completely worthless during that whole crisis, Bill kind of just
takes charge.
Takes charge and just tries to do something, right? Turns out he saved the lives of everybody there, which just earns him a beatdown from Noisy because
he makes him look foolish.
Yeah, he made him look like an idiot
and yelled at him. So, yeah, the one thing I enjoyed about this was seeing Heinlein as a writer trying to weave in scouting because of the audience that he was writing for. And I had remembered thinking early on, because there's obviously weight limitations around what they can take on the colony ship.
Yeah.
And somehow there's two aspects of that were amusing. I think were fun parts of the story. One was that, as could only happen in the 50s, Bill is a pretty decent accordion player.
Right.
And so somehow, there's no way he can be able to afford the weight limitations for the accordion. But his father says, have you read the regulations? And here, yeah, by the way, it might be a cultural device. And so he goes before the board and plays, I think, two or three tunes on his accordion to prove that it has merit. And as a result, they're able to take it along. The other one was he has this affinity for his scouting uniform, and he just can't seem to part with it. And I thought that's really an interesting, why are we worried about that? And it's like, well, yes, okay, we're trying to please the scouts. And then it comes down to be that because of this uniform, we save everybody. And so it's good. The scouting part did, I think, serve a lot of purposes, particularly not only on board, but also at Ganymede, which was to organize the youth and sort of give them a way to continue to expand Bill's horizons in terms of other characters that we would write into there. At one point on the ship, they actually find a child that is lost in a fairly large ship. And the scouts are one of the ones that lead the search party to find them. And so it becomes very, very useful. And he meets a number of different characters, including Papa Schultz, who is, I think, at one of the Court of Honors that they had. So, but it was interesting to sort of see how Heinlein had to wrap this in to make it palatable for the publication.
Right. Yeah. I did enjoy too, that the fact that here they have these, you know, coming from the crowded earth, they've got this pie in the sky notion that we're going to get to Ganymede and everything's going to be cool. Right. Everything's going to be great. And then they get off the ship and the existing colonists on Ganymede are like, well, what are we going to do with you people?
Right.
You know, we wanted machines. We didn't want more people.
Yeah, I think Heinlein, in several places in the book, maybe describes some of the views he had toward the efficiency or lack thereof of government.
Yes.
Because there are several times that the scene where the entitled got onto the ship, even though they weren't the best suitable for that. And then there's an actual desire to send as many of these excess bodies off planet as they can. And so they continue to send them, even though they've never sent up enough equipment and the equipment is yet to be able to be synthesized on Ganymede or any of these other satellites like that. And so when they find out how long it's going to take them to be able to start to work their own land and to build what would be the farm aspect is in the upwards of, you know, 2 years.
Yeah.
It starts a little bit of a revolt among some of the adults. And so it paints the picture of government that is a bit feckless and also not very effective on there. Including one part where George is talking about Bill going back to Earth to finish his schooling and then come back so that he'll be, because Bill would like to be an engineer like his father eventually.
Right.
And there's no way to do it other than to pledge your land or to give your land up, which is the most valuable piece of assets that they have on Ganymede.
Yeah.
His dad apparently has a fair amount of money back on Earth, but it's somehow not accessible. The government has effectively said you can't access this money as a part of, I assume, the freight for having sent you out on the colony ship.
Right. Yeah, I'm curious if they could have liquidated all of that before they emigrated to Ganymede. But I think there was always the contingency plan of going back to Earth.
There was, I think, yep. And I don't know that George ever really fully gave up on the idea of Bill going back and getting his education.
Yeah, no, I mean, even right at the end of the book, he's still trying to convince him to do that.
Correct. Yep.
You know, you do get some of the description of how it's different on Ganymede and how they've made it habitable, right? And there's the Chekhov's heat trap, right, where they mention the kind of forced greenhouse effect, which you would definitely need because I think, I don't know, I think normally Ganymede temperatures are well in the hundreds of degrees below zero.
Correct.
And so, yeah, there would need to be, I think the even I've heard that the that Jupiter gives off more heat than it receives from the sun, just through whatever is going on Jupiter. But so the sun is much less intense, obviously, there. So you have to have that heat trap there. It mentions a bunch of the plants that they grow on Ganymede are either they're labeled either MG, which is mutant Ganymede, or NT, normal terrestrial. So I thought it was funny. He's way ahead of the curve on GMOs, essentially, right?
Yeah, he had several things in that book that were, I think, interesting along those lines. The microwave, you know, we're still a little bit a ways away from it, but personal helicopters, or at least the ability to have personal aircraft that could take you places. You know, even like I said, the aspect of spinning the hole to create the gravity wasn't, I don't think, known at that point in time. I don't know that there was a significant amount of information known about sort of getting what they call it, drop sick, effectively getting your stomach turned upside down from weightlessness. I don't know that they would necessarily have known that as well at that point. Maybe they did, but
Well, the other thing is the different atmospheric pressure on Ganymede, where it's oxygen rich enough to be breathable, but much lower pressure than we're generally used to. I mean, it's kind of like on when you look at astronauts aboard the ISS, their faces look puffy, and it's because the partial pressure of oxygen is more, but there's less overall pressure, and so normally we don't think of the fact of the weight of air and how it pushes on us. But when you have that lower pressure, all of a sudden your face puffs up because there isn't as much air pushing on it.
Right. And it also had lower gravity as well.
Yeah. It's only like a third of gravity. And that doesn't come too much into, how exactly do you get around, what is walking like in that environment? Cause that's like the moon's gravity, isn't it?
Right. Yep. And, there was a couple of times where it led to sort of fun descriptions. So Papa Schultz comes bounding over, and Papa Schultz is a large man.
Yes.
And he comes bounding over, and I can just, I have visions of the Apollo astronauts on the moon.
Right.
With that kind of stride that they had. So.
Yeah. And of course, you have the problem where Peggy never really adapts to the lower pressure. And I'm not sure if that's would be a real thing or not.
Yeah. I don't know that I've read anything that tells me that that's not true, but I mean, we understand from deep sea divers that too much pressure obviously causes the reverse of that, and so it might not be out of the realm of possibilities. But I don't know what the air pressure is inside the ISS, but we've obviously had astronauts there for long periods of time, maybe not years and years, but we certainly have had them for more than a year. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they're at half pressure or what they are at, but that, and that was another part of the book that I thought Heinlein didn't shy away from for a youth oriented book. And that is, he's not afraid to point out the dark side of what could happen.
Sure. He mentions it several times, right? That plenty of colonies die out to the last person.
Right.
I mean, that happens, it's happened on Earth, right?
Correct.
In space, it's even more dangerous.
Yeah, well, and he highlighted some of those, I think, in the Earth part. Well, maybe throughout the entire book, but early in the Earth part, they talked about the Donner Party and
Roanoke
Colony and others. So it's, the book reads very much like a pioneer story, which it is. I think back to how Star Trek was sold as Wagon Train to the Stars, which is the plot of We visit a new location every week. That's what he was describing when Roddenberry said that, as opposed to the true wagon train, which was settlers going to a new location. And this is a true wagon train, taking them out from that standpoint. I don't know how, I don't know how plausible the description of how they grew soil was.
Right.
It sounded good.
Yeah. I thought it sounded pretty good too. And you know, in terms of the only introducing what you want to introduce into the soil, just soil, the beneficial bacteria and that kind of stuff, but no weeds, right? It was fun for me because they have the rock crushers that come along and would you know, take anything down from like a 5 gallon bucket size into essentially gravel or large rocks. And then he had a smaller machine builded that he could use called a cud chewer.
yes.
That would take the gravel and produce sand more or less. And then, right. You know, even you could go even finer and it would go down to like flour. And that reminds me of during college, one of the jobs that I had was for a place that did assay prep for gold companies in Alaska, where they would take core samples and then send it to our prep lab. And we would dry it all out and then put it through a crusher and put it through a thing called a pulverizer that would turn it into, it looked like powdered sugar by the time we were done with it. And we'd take, you know, representative sample of it, send it off to the lab to check for quartz and other trace minerals so that they could decide where do we want to try and put a mine. But that was a very dirty job.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Because it's all volcanic rock on Ganymede, right? That's what they're crushing. And so I was just sitting there thinking about when you look at the aftermath of a volcano and the ash and the rock and crushing it up, I have this vision of a permanent cloud of volcanic
dust.
Dust that's floating around Ganymede. But maybe with the low pressure and the low gravity, it settles. But
my mother-in-law lives on the big island of Hawaii, and she had a rental property that got destroyed by one of the recent lava flows. And walking through that neighborhood is interesting right now because there's a whole place where just all of a sudden the road ends, and there's just this massive place where the lava flowed through and still is flowing.
Yeah.
So whereas Ganymede is a little, I mean, it's not geologically completely inactive, right? Because, and this comes into it, right? They do have earthquakes.
Yes.
Not earthquakes, moonquakes, I suppose you'd call them. Because you do have some orbital resonance there where you have the tidal forces from Jupiter and then from the other moons. Ganymede is far enough out that it doesn't experience as much of that as some of the other. I think Io is one of the ones that gets pulled on from both sides. And so there's lots of evidence that there's cataclysmic earthquakes and that kind of stuff on Io, but it is introduced at least as here's something that could happen. Then of course it does happen. And that's really bad.
It is. And they had this foretelling of it in the Earth part where, it was his best friend that was making fun of, was excited to go, wanted George to sponsor him and had a conversation with his own father and then started making fun of him around that and effectively said, well, my father says that you don't want to be that far away if something bad happens. And George describes it as, well, that's going to happen no matter where you're at. It can be something as simple as that. But he sort of plays it off as that it, you know, probably is not likely to happen.
Sure.
And lo and behold, it's going to happen after. It's the same thing as saying that, he's, you know, hit all of his free throws tonight. And all of a sudden, the next free throw player shoots, they miss. It's the same thing. I've just said it's not going to happen. So therefore, it must happen later in the story. And it does.
Right.
I think it's one of those things where, because of what was known about Jupiter and the satellites at that time, what Heinlein wrote seemed like it could happen, which was that all of the moons align and that caused this massive moonquake on Ganymede. I don't think that they ever actually get aligned because of the differences in the orbits and the speed at which they orbit.
Right.
But there was obviously no way to know that. It was well before, Voyager?
So. And Galileo,
right? Yep. But it does create this this significant event where two things happen almost immediately. One, there is just a cataclysmic earthquake, which brings down the family's house, and then brings down several other obviously the residents' locations, and they pass away from that aspect of it. But the worst thing is that the heatsink goes out.
Yeah.
And you know, they're trying to get Peggy to town because they've had an explosive decompression of the room that they set up for her because she never does adapt to the lower air pressure. And Bill says, George, something's wrong with the sky. And that's when George realizes that the heat sink has gone out and that they're going to have a much bigger problem, which is it'll be, as things you referenced earlier, something like 100 below. And there's going to be a significant amount of death and or issues with that. And so they're trying to get back to town where they can get Peggy into the hospital, and then also get the comfort and have heat of some kind because they don't have the power generating stations either. I think at that point in time, they're all working on backup power.
I'm not totally sure about the atmospheric dynamics of the heat trap. You know, I know that like on Earth, our atmosphere is thick and complex. And so it makes it so that, yeah, we have the solstice on the 21st of June, but we don't get our hottest weather until August. And the same thing, we have our winter solstice in December, but we get our coldest weather in February. Because it takes that amount of time for all of that thermodynamic activity to take place. Ganymede, the atmosphere is thinner, but I have a hard time believing that it would be just hours that it would drop that fast, but it is possible.
Yeah, because I assume that what they're describing is that it's, I don't know, maybe it doesn't go into that much detail. I can't remember, but I would assume that it's somewhat related to gas that has been manufactured that is released into the atmosphere to create the greenhouse effect.
Right. Yeah, so I guess it's possible if all that gets ripped away suddenly, but then you would think they would lose their oxygen as well.
Right.
So I think he says at some point it gets down to something like minus 70, which is, I've experienced that. That's no fun.
Nope.
You can go out in it if you're prepared for it, but you don't want to be out there for very long.
No.
And of course they lose track of the Schultzes at this point. And eventually come to find out that the Schultzes are okay. And for people who haven't read the book, the Schultzes are essentially pretty prosperous farmers. They've got a really good operation going, lots of animals, and they have a tree, right? They have the one apple tree on Ganymede, and that's what saves them, more or less. They're able to burn their tree to stay alive.
Right, Papa Schultz is always giving out apples with the idea, take the seeds, and Bill ends up working for Papa Schultz, I assume primarily a gift from the Schultzes to their neighbors because he has what, three, four boys. He's got two or three girls. He's got a plethora of
capable
farmhands already. They take on Bill, I assume for two reasons. One, a future husband for Gretchen, who is Bill's age, although Bill is too naive and blind to ever pick up on that.
Yeah. Although he does admire her, right? He says something about how, you know, she could slaughter a chicken while, you know, a normal girl would still be screaming.
That's right. He's very practical about his appreciation for her. When they have the house raising for Bill and his family, he makes the comment that why don't we have, I forget her name, Sally or something of that nature, come in, and she storms off because it's like, why would you, you know? So it's like, well, Bill, you never really did pick up on this. So.
Yeah.
But it had that. And then also the other was to make it easier for George and Molly and Peggy to sort of deal with the fact that Peggy's in the hospital still because of the atmosphere, and also to teach Bill how to farm. Mm-hmm. It's effectively, they don't really need, whereas the sort of the town council, for lack of a better term for it, basically says, you know, we've arranged it for you to have sort of farm hands with various farmers and help them grow the crops and such, which causes several of them to say, that's not what I signed up for, to be a sharecropper.
Right. Because they're given like 5 acres, and the deal is you have to develop some of it so that we can pass it on to a future colonist.
Correct.
Or, you know, for the colony itself, and that you pay that back, and then you have your own land to work.
Yep. And so it's very practical of the Schultzes to be neighborly, number one, And then to help Bill have a chance to prosper with probably the idea of marrying Gretchen off to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and just having good neighbors, good relationships with your neighbors, right? That's important.
Yep. They're very, they're very good neighbors in that regard. Everything they do is about that. When they, I think when they were terraforming the land, the Schultz boys come over with fuel barrels full of garbage to effectively help to grow the soil.
Yeah. Yeah. That would take some time.
It would. Yep.
And I like the, you know, the description of kind of laying down the compost and the, what do they call it? Pay dirt in strips so that then it'll kind of radiate out from there.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And it was, I thought it's not a book about farming per se, but I thought that was a good description as to what you would go through. And it actually made, Papa Schultz sort of makes fun of himself saying that they think I'm crazy old Johann. Right. For growing this apple tree, which saves them at the end of the day. But mm-hmm. He's very good at farming, and he's figured out how to make it work. And he is a very prosperous farmer in a variety of things. They have a fireplace, which is not needed until it's needed. So that worked out well. And mm-hmm. they're going to put windows into their building, mm-hmm. which is all made out of rock. I have to admit that product of the 60s, when they talked about these rock houses, I've always, throughout the entire book, I had the vision of the Flintstones house. I know that's not what it was, but but that's what I kept visioning, especially when at the end there, George and Bill are, after the earthquake, are taking slabs off. I just thought, yeah, that does reinforce my idea that this is a Flintstones house.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah. So yeah, in the course of the whole disaster and the losing the heat trap, something like 2/3 of the population dies. And then we kind of get the fast forward to the rebuild.
That's right.
Where there's discussions about leaving and there's that kind of nice moment when Bill and George are looking over the manifest for who's going back. And they say, I don't really want to get lumped in with that group because we're not quitters.
Yeah. It's all the people that Heinlein has set up to be sort of the whiners or the people that offered no real value are the ones going back. And yeah, Bill says, I don't want to get lumped in with those lugs.
Yeah. So ultimately they do stay on and start rebuilding. Bill then decides that he wants to see more of Ganymede and signs off with the exploration group looking for new colony sites, signs on as a cook.
Yes.
What do they call him? Slop?
Dr. Slop.
Dr. Slop. That's right.
Yes. So it took me a while to understand that I had to listen to it two or three times because for whatever reason, I just either kept getting distracted or I just didn't click with me until about the third time I listened to it. And that the surveyor was somebody that worked for the Earth government.
Right.
And I kept trying to figure out what it was all laying up to, but effectively, it's somebody that befriends Bill and is the one that, hired him on to be the cook, which was about the only way he was going to go because he wasn't of age, I think, for the expedition.
Yeah.
He was just
too young. Yeah.
Right. And so it tells that, and it leads to one of the more interesting dialogues in that section of the book.
With Paul
around what he thought would happen on Earth, which is effectively at some point in time in the next 70 years, there would be a war by his reckoning sooner than that because of,
population pressures
and such.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I can't say he was necessarily wrong on a lot of that. And that's some of, you know, Heinlein on his soapbox talking about that and kind of like earlier with his father talking about, well, think of how contingent our modern cities are on, you know, one major thing breaks down and what happens.
Right. Yes. And we saw several examples of that in the last several years of supply chain being a part of that.
Yeah.
Then we had the power grid being cyber attacked and what that did. So
right. My son goes to University of Texas and so he got to see that 9 degrees it got down to in Austin and lots of places lost power, lost water. There's vulnerable infrastructure all over the place.
There is.
So this is then all of a sudden you have the sudden alien remnant technology.
Yeah, that sort of felt like a tack on at the end, which to your point, it does feel like it's setting it up for further adventures of Bill because he talks about going to Callisto. and others, and they set this up where and Hank again is vital to the survival of Bill, who gets sick while
ill-timed appendicitis,
right? Burst appendix, and they have this. I saw an illustration for this on one of the websites for
For the Walker wagon.
Right. Yes, and it looks like a giant mechanized caterpillar.
Okay. Yeah. He says it has what, 19 legs per side, right? 38 legs total.
Yep.
I was picturing like a centipede almost.
Yep. Yep. And so that's what it looked like from that standpoint. And it sort of sets it up that they find this whole sort of elaborate hangar, so to speak, where there's all of this equipment. And so there are two things that come out of that. One, it could lead to trying to figure out who they are and therefore further adventures. But it also suggests that there might be other, because in that whole discussion Paul has around making Ganymede self-sufficient so that they don't get embroiled in the coming wars on Earth, equipment is going to be the key aspect to that. People and equipment are going to be the key. That's what they're at in the expedition, trying to find other potential places for settlement, also setting up other powerhouses so that they don't have a catastrophic from that standpoint. But now we have all this equipment that could probably be repurposed into developing the land, developing the property, developing Ganymede as a true colony. So that, I think, solved that part of it.
Yeah. And so then you have the abrupt end of the book, right? Where he realizes that, nope, Ganymede is my home. I'm not going back to, you know, I'm going to do my merit badges, but I'm not going to go back to Earth to finish my education. So yeah, it does definitely feel like the first book in a series. So I was a little disappointed. I went and looked to see if I could find any other further adventures of Bill, but
there's not. That. And, like you said, it could be in the sort of universe, but I think the closest tie that they have is the song that they sing. I think.
Oh, the Green Hills of Earth.
Right. The Green Hills of Earth, I think, are in one or two of the other books that come before this.
Okay. My paperback version of it is from the 2000s at some point. It has an afterword in it by Dr. Jim Moseley called Terraforming Ganymede, Science and Technology in Robert A. Heinlein's Farmer in the Sky. And it was pretty interesting. I didn't bring in a ton of material from that. I just skimmed it yesterday. But I've actually reached out to Dr. Woosley, and I'm hoping that I can get him on for an interview just about, you know, true science of science fiction.
Well, that'd be good. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's an author that I read on the adventure side, James Rollins, that always has a fair amount of addendum that describes that the science that he's he's got science and archaeology and mythology and a variety of things. He's always well sourced to the reality of what it could be. And I think that was interesting that was in that part of the paperback, because it does sound very plausible the way that everything is written. I'm sure that there's, you know, in a larger tome, which is more around this hard science, there's more to be said about it, but it I think set up the imagination. I feel like these series of books and this one inspires lots of themes that run through other science fiction.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously we see scarce resources show up in books like Stand on Zanzibar, Make Room, Make Room, a variety of those. Obviously Heinlein writes a fair amount about colonization in his other juveniles and his other books from that standpoint. And it feels like in some various aspects of these books, they end up influencing a number of other authors throughout the years.
Well, I think I've come to the end of my notes. So final thoughts?
I think it's, if you're looking for a way to get into Heinlein, if Heinlein has been an author that sort of has intimidated you, this is a good place to start.
Yeah. Yeah. I this one definitely goes down easier than something like Stranger in a Strange Land.
Right.
I really like Double Star. That is a fun one that I felt like went down easy. I'm trying to convince my Take Me to Your Reader co-hosts to discuss that one as an or as having been adapted into the Kevin Kline movie Dave, because it's essentially exactly the same plot.
Exactly. Yep.
But yeah, it's a good place, I think, to start with Heinlein. And I haven't read many of the other juveniles. I think technically Starship Troopers counts as one.
It was. It was rejected by Scribner. And he had this love-hate relationship with the editor there that published all of the juveniles. I think he absolutely hated every note he got. But she was a proponent of his, and so in terms of his goal of broadening science fiction's appeal by getting into young boys' sort of lexicon earlier was accomplished, and obviously he did well at it to have a sort of another source of income on there.
Yeah.
But they effectively rejected Starship Trooper, and he said, that's it. And he says, I'm never submitting another thing to Scribner, and he went and had it published. There are some people will say that, what is it, Podkayne of Mars is a juvenile. I don't think that Heinlein ever pictured it that way as it is, even though it's a young girl. So
I haven't read that one. I have one more Heinlein title to cover for the winners of the Hugo and Retro Hugo. So that one will be fun. And I have a fun guest for that one, but I'm not going to spoil it.
There you go. Yep.
So speaking of which, thank you, Rick, for picking this book and coming on the podcast, using the contact form.
Yes, Seth, thank you. Appreciate the discussion.
Do you have any online presence, social media?
I do.
You want to give out?
I have a Twitter account called Smartass Sci-Fi.
All right.
Which is a little bit of what my wife tells me that I am.
Nice.
One of my favorite authors has always been Harry Harrison. I started reading him when I read Make Room, Make Room, which is obviously the basis for Soylent Green.
Right.
I actually went the opposite way. I saw Soylent Green and was intrigued by it as a movie. And I had seen The Omega Man. I then saw Soylent Green somewhat after that. And I already obviously knew every Easter, like every good kid in America, I saw Charlton Heston as Moses.
Right. The Ten Commandments.
So I was intrigued to watch it. I liked the story so much, I started to figure out what was the basis behind it and came to Harry Harrison. And then I started reading his more satirical works. And he does a significant amount of satire. Star Smashers of the Galaxy Rangers is a takeoff on effectively the Lensman series and Skylark and a variety of those. And it's very much tongue-in-cheek. If you read it thinking it's a serious fiction piece, you will be appalled at the treatment of a variety of topics in there. Although at the end of the day, the two characters are at least gay, so that is fine. But that's how I came to enjoy reading that. And then I read all of his Stainless Steel Rats books, which are all have a very sarcastic side to them. And so that's what my Twitter handle is. And that's where Perfect. People would find me the most.
Nice. Well, on that note, we did do Make Room, Make Room and Soylent Green for Take Me to Your Reader. So if you're interested in that and listeners of this podcast, if you've not checked out my other podcast, Take Me to Your Reader, you know, check that out.
You should check it out. It's actually, so obviously I heard you talk about that at one of your early episodes I picked up, and I listened to those as well. And it is a delightful discussion around there between you and your host. So,
well, thank you. All right, Rick. Well, this was a lot of fun. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast and having a good discussion.
Well, thank you, Seth. I appreciate it as well.
All right. Bye. Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Rick. I thought that was a lot of fun, a fun book to talk about as well. As I mentioned in the podcast, I only have three titles left that are unclaimed. And so I just want to go ahead and say what they are. And so if you're interested in any of these, reach out to me in the various ways. So I still have Shadow Over Mars by Lee Brackett, which was one of the recent retro winners. I have The Wanderer from Fritz Leiber. And I have the most recent winner, A Desolation Called Peace by Arkady Martin. So if you want to get in touch for that or for any other reason, you can shoot an email, feedback@hugospodcast.com. You can go up to the website like Rick did and fill out the contact form there at hugospodcast.com. I also, of course, have the full list of everything that I've covered there. So if you're interested, you know, you're just finding this podcast and you're wondering what other episodes has he covered in his, you know, 70 plus episodes on the winners, to say nothing of the other episodes that I've done, you can do that. You can also tweet at me at Hugo's Podcast. I think I did create a Mastodon account, but I haven't really gone over there yet. We'll see what happens with Twitter. I also want to reiterate, Take Me to Your Reader is another podcast that I do. We do episodes monthly. I think it's a lot of fun. If you like hearing from me, then you can hear me interact with two of my close friends. and we talk about movies that are adapted from books. And we have a good time there, and we have over 100 episodes there. You can also go up to patreon.com/hugospodcast if you would like to support financially what I do here and on my other podcasting. That being said, thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.